greatness of our country. We believe in the goodness, the charity, and love of people, and therefore we have hope. And that is, but the goodness of the American people is, and the young people in our country and their aspirations for something better and their willingness to act upon that gives me hope. But I also have hope is owning the ground in a grassroots election and getting out your vote. And I also have hope in a message that is unifying to America, not divisive or threatening, but progressive, bold, unifying. Now, people say to me, well, it's not bold enough or something. I said, you know what? What works in Wisconsin works in San Francisco. What works in San Francisco may not work in Wisconsin. And we must win Wisconsin. We will win San Francisco. So, no, but it's, we have to have our common ground. We don't pull our punch. We don't lessen our commitment. But we find our common ground. And I say in my caucus, our diversity is our strength, but our unity is our power. And the power of our country is in agreeing to disagree, but in a way that is not dividing our country. We've been taken down a terrible path by a certain person who for a short time occupied the White House, never to go there again. I'm serious about that. It can never happen again.
Well, I would like to talk to you a little bit about your book, The Art of Power, although as I was reading it, I was thinking it could just as easily have been named The Skill of Power or The Talent of Power. And it's not meant to be a memoir. You kind of hint at the end that that book may come someday, and I certainly hope it does. But what people know about your story, you were the daughter of a congressman who became the mayor of Baltimore, five older brothers, baby of the family. But people might hear that and assume that you always had figured you were going to grow up to be Nancy Pelosi, that, you know, that this always felt like this was your destiny. And I know we've talked about this before. As the baby and the only girl in the family, were those the expectations that you felt as a child?
No. No, I didn't feel that at all. I was a 50s teenager, rock around the clock, Elvis Presley, come on, forget politics, what was that? We were, thank you for going back to my family history, which I'm just, is always such a source of strength to me. I was raised in the, Peter, you'll appreciate this, Peter Barca, we share our Italian-American heritage, grew up in the Italian-American section of Baltimore, in Little Italy in Baltimore, Maryland, and in our family we were devoutly Catholic, proud of our Italian-American heritage, fiercely patriotic, and staunchly Democratic. Now, that I say that separately because some of the other things we shared with many other families. But in those days, being Democratic and Republican wasn't what it has turned into like right now. It was, you respected people for their interest in public service, whatever side of the aisle they were on. But no, I had absolutely no interest whatsoever. In fact, I was a very shy person. I still am. But, and that's why I love to see some of these candidates go out there and just be so in the spotlight. And I think that's great. Now, so here's the thing. I was able to go away to college, girls, Catholic college, 45 minutes from home. That was the extent of my freedom. That was beautiful, and I loved it. Trinity College, all women's Catholic college. Okay, Trinity College. And then I married Paul, and I had five children in 6 years and 7 days, as I remind my as I remind my archbishop who excommunicated me, but anyway, that's his problem. But in Washington, the cardinal said communion will not be withheld from anyone because of whatever thoughts they have about a woman's right to choose. Anyway, so when you have five children in that short period of time, you don't have time for anything. I mean, you don't even have time to wash your face. This is it. So when they're in school all day, which eventually comes, I always just say I had the best life and some of the worst days because you just never finished working. But nonetheless, when they were in school all day, then I started to volunteer in the Democratic Party. Then soon I became the chair of the party. But I never intended to run myself. I loved working behind the scenes for candidates and the causes. Something like what Ben Whitler does. Isn't he just the best? Isn't he the best? I'm such an admirer of his, and as you should, I know you all are, I heard your reaction to him, but you should know he's received that way all over the country on the infrequent occasions when he leaves Wisconsin. And he said to me one day in Washington, I'm going home to Wisconsin because I think it's the best place to raise a family. And here he is. Here he is. I don't know where he is, but here he is, somebody. In any event, but what bothered me was that my why, I'm a mom of five, and one in five children in America goes to sleep hungry each night, lives in poverty, goes to sleep. So that was my mission, to be engaged in politics, to prepare candidates, do the grassroots work, all the rest of that. So in any case, that's what I did. Then they came to me and said, you love the issues, you love the policy, you should run for Congress. Our congresswoman wanted to retire, and she said, I would feel so much better if you would run. But I had never, I'm telling to each one of you, never had one thought of running for Congress or anything. It just wasn't who I was. I was shy. So anyway, that was then, but anyway. So anyway, I go to my daughter, Alexandra. Some of you have heard this story because I tell it. It's the answer to this question. We had four of them in college and one going into senior year in high school. And she was 16. She was young, going into senior years. So, Alexandra, mommy has been asked to run for Congress. I've never even given it a thought to do such a thing, but people are asking me to run, and Sala Burton, who is the congresswoman, really wants me to think about it, and I said I'd have to ask you. Now, here's what it is. I don't know if I'll even win, but if I run, and if I were to win, I'd be gone three nights a week, Monday through Thursday, something like that. And but if any answer is good, if you want me to stay, I'm happy to stay, but otherwise I'd be gone three nights a week. Mother, now mind you, I ask mommy, mother, get a life. No, I'd never heard that expression. This is over 35 years ago. I'd never heard that expression. Get a life. What teenage girl doesn't want her mother out of the house three nights a week? So I went housewife, house member, house speaker.
Except when you get to the house, there aren't a lot of women there, and there is a sort of real pecking order among the men who are running the place. And at that point, the Democrats, starting in the mid-90s, were kind of wandering in the wilderness and couldn't win back a majority. How open were the men who were running the place to your ideas for doing things differently?
Well, when I went to Congress, there were 23 women out of 435 people. 35 women. I mean, 23 women, 11 Republicans and 12 Democrats. Immediately, being the former chair, I was like, this has to change. We have to make this different. We now have 94 Democratic women. They have like 30-something. We still all need more. But nonetheless, at the same time, our caucus is 70% women, people of color, LGBTQ. And that's a fabulous thing. Anyway, going back to then, I loved my committee assignments, appropriations, intelligence, all of that. And people came to me and said, you should run for leadership. I said, oh, no, I'm not running for leadership. No, you should run for leadership. We have to change something. This has to. I said, I'm not running for leadership. So I didn't. And then we lost in 94 and 96 and 98. And then it was like, I'm tired of losing. I know how to win elections. So I decided that I would run for whip, which was the position had been become open because David Bonner, who was the whip, was then leaving to run for governor of Michigan. So I said I would run. So the men, I always thought we would have a woman president long before we'd ever have a woman in leadership in the Congress, because you're not talking glass ceiling here. We're talking serious marble ceiling. This is not. And so when I was running, they basically said, you know, we have a pecking order here. These men have been waiting a long time for a position to open up, and this one and that one and that and that. And that. So that's the way it is. There's a pecking order. I said, yeah, and there's an election, and we've been waiting over 200 years, and and so what? So much for your pecking order. Then they would say things like, and these are people I love. I mean, they're just really nice, but, you know. So they just didn't know. You know. So then they said, probably one of my personal favorites, who said she could run? Poor babies. As if I were waiting for their permission, all right? Okay. And so then they said, oh, this is further babyhood. Then they said, okay, why don't you all just write down on a piece of paper some of the things that the women in Congress would like to see done that hasn't been done, and then we'll do them for you. This was in this century. It's not that long ago. So, well, we went from being, oh, interesting, when there were 23, to when our numbers grew, oh, it was challenging, but then they were going to hold the line. But they were all lovely. They're my friends. I respect them. But it was just interesting. So then I don't want you, and I think this holds for this election too, I don't want you voting for me because I'm a woman. And I don't want you voting against me because I'm a woman. I want you to listen to what I have to say about policy and politics and what we can do for the people. And then I won. We won the Congress and I got the gavel. After the gavel, it's a different world.
A couple of weeks before you left the speakership, you had some reporters in for lunch. You had us in for lunch in it's a very famous room in the Capitol that used to be Sam Rayburn's, what they called the Board of Education. And Speaker Pelosi told us something that you could just hear all of our jaws drop. You told us that the first time you ever set foot in a Democratic speaker's office was when you were the Democratic speaker. Yeah. So that sort of tells you how closed the system really was for
Imagine
women.
That. Never been in there. And I had been in the Republican speaker's office because I was the Democratic leader. So I would go to negotiate to his office, but never to the Democratic speaker's office. But they kept things in close. So, you know, but in any event, they were all reasonably fine after that. Yeah.
Well, in this book, you go through a number of key moments that sort of marked your tenure as Democratic leader, but there's one in particular I want to ask you about, because I was in the chamber that day, and that was the day, and this was like the most amazing high wire act of legislating I think any of us had ever seen, which was getting the Affordable Care Act through the House. And just so you can understand the degree of difficulty, the Senate, which had been kind of dragging their feet all along anyway, had lost, with the death of Senator Ted Kennedy, their 60th vote that made their bill filibuster-proof. So the Speaker had to pass the exact same bill that the Senate had passed, even though a lot of her members didn't like it. Some of her members knew that that vote was going to potentially end their career. I'm thinking, for instance, of Tom Perriello, who you talk about in the book. And in what I now find a chilling omen of what happened on January 6th, the Capitol was surrounded by thousands and thousands of protesters.
The day of Affordable Care Act, we're talking now. Yeah.
Yes, yes. As it's coming to the House vote, and she is having to pick these votes up one by one by one. And things outside the Capitol are so bad that, well, maybe you should talk about what happened to John Lewis as he was just, well, as John Lewis was walking to the chamber that day through all these screaming protesters, people were spitting on him. And he told Speaker Pelosi it was the worst thing he had seen since the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. It was the most anger and the worst treatment. So that is the environment that you are trying to get this done.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that when Senator Kennedy passed away and we lost the 60 votes, the press said to me, you're dead. Words to that effect, it's over for you. I said, no, this is an opportunity, a challenge of a generation. For 100 years, presidents have tried, Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Truman, and all have been trying until we had Medicare with Lyndon Johnson. That was one of the first breakthroughs. And when he signed it in Independence, Missouri, so President Truman, who had worked so hard on that but didn't achieve it, could be there for this. So anyway, we had a generational challenge. So I said, we're not going to let anything stand in our way. If there's a barrier to this, we'll break through the grate, push open the gate. If that doesn't work, we'll climb the wall. If that doesn't work, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll helicopter in. But we're not letting anything stand in the way of passing this bill. And so, and I want to say, Ron Kind was very, I'm just mentioning one from Michigan who at the time was on the Ways and Means Committee, because and what was, we didn't like this, let me say it another way, we did not like the Senate bill. That it was ridiculous in my view, but nonetheless, it was the best that they could do. So, but President Obama stuck with us on it, and we were able, read the book and you'll see it in the book. It's no use going into it, but the challenge between the House and the Senate, quite frankly, if Senator Kennedy had not passed away, I'm not even sure we would have had all 60 of those votes. But we did get them for our amendments to our bill. But again, it's too complex. Unless we spent the whole night on that, it's easier just to read it in the book if you're interested. But it was remarkable. It was remarkable. And it took this is what, and those, so after it was over, those guys at press, they said, and some were women, but mostly it was the guys who were challenging your dad. They said, which one did you do? The gate. I said, we just pushed open the gate because you know why? We had the courage of the members that we needed those votes. But we also had the outside mobilization. Without the outside mobilization, without the groups with for one diagnosis or another, with people who are healthcare providers, all the rest saying we have to have this change, we must make it accessible, affordable, and quality. We must have do away with the pre-existing condition barrier. We must not be have being a woman being a pre-existing medical condition. Women were paying 50% more. We can't have a situation where we have a limit on what insurance companies pay, whether it's annual or lifetime. And the pre-existing condition and the lifetime and, or annual limits were the biggest, shall we say, threshold to cross because we had, well, we had insurance industry, you know, had all of the, shall we say, vested interest fighting against us. But it was really a fight. And when John Lewis, you see, John and I carried the gavel over to use it to bring it. So we're a few of us there walking together and then the whole caucus behind us. And when we were parading over from the Cannon Building to the Capitol, which is not from here to the back of the room, they were screaming and yelling and spitting on John Lewis. You have to understand, John Lewis was our guiding light, our North Star, the most beautiful man. I served with him for over 30 years in the Congress. He was my dear friend. In fact, for his funeral, right before he died, I brought him this pin, and he wanted to have it about, and then we had him lie in state on the same platform that was built for Lincoln to lie in state. So that's how we revered him. And these people were spitting on him, so you can just imagine. One of them was dressed up like a nun, too. But the nun, but the nuns saved us. The nuns were, forget the bishop. The nuns nun saved us. But it was hard. And then when we lost the, and I even said, if Hillary wins, I don't have to stay because she will protect the Affordable Care Act. This was such an important kitchen table issue for people, the cost of health care and the rest. And she, but then he came. And I said to him, I said, Mr. President, I will say to you what I've said to other presidents. I will never ask you to do anything that is not in your interest. And I think it would be in your interest for us to talk about how we can advance the Affordable Care Act. He didn't have the faintest interest. They tried maybe scores of times to repeal it. He said he was going to repeal and replace. I don't know what he was going to replace with because I don't even know what it was. But nonetheless, scores of times, and then we had to fight them again. 10,000 events around the country of people coming to tell their stories. I'm not talking about the provisions of the bill, their stories. My child was born, my baby was born, needed a heart operation, right? What would have cost $1 million, this, you know, those kinds of stories. And other stories about especially pre-existing conditions or cancer diagnoses. So in any event, John McCain saved the day. You know, this was the thumbs down heard round the world on that. So now, what's his name is saying, forgive me, I know we're in a sacred place, Obamacare sucks. That's what he says. And now he's saying he was only there to save it.
Yeah, the exact quote from last week's debate from President Trump when he was asked about the Affordable Care Act, which is pretty popular these days, was that he was going to, quote, save it and make it as good as it can be. So were you as startled as I was to hear that?
One thing you have to know about him is forgetting that statement because he's not on a level, so let's not even think of that. But And see, it's hard for me because I want to bring us together and all, but this is... So, in any event, he says Obamacare sucks. No, we said, no, it doesn't suck. It cures. And that's what this is about. But he definitely wanted to get rid of it because that's where the money was. Health insurance industry, anti-government, shall we say, exuberance enthusiasts who don't want to pay taxes. This was paid for. We had it all paid. It was all paid for. And he just couldn't understand it. But why are we talking about him? Let's talk about Kamala Harris if we're going to talk. But if you have a pre-existing condition, beware of anything he has to say. He's really, what he does is he projects. Like he says, crazy Nancy, he's crazy. Crooked Hillary, he's crooked. Every adjective he uses is really about himself. And so that's what you have to understand. So when he's saying that people eat cats and dogs, I'm just wondering about him.
Well, so you held a position more powerful than any other woman in American history. And you decided the time had come to step away from that position. And yet, and this is after you become the first speaker since Sam Rayburn to stay and fight for your majority back. And then you step away from the job. Could you talk a little bit about generational change in the House? In the House, yes.
Yeah, well, we're very proud of our generation. What you have to understand is since I became leader, whip leader, then speaker, the whole idea of diversity in the leadership changed. So it was viewed differently. It was like, well, we have wonderful talent. And when you have the job that I have, and it was a hard job, I mean, I probably didn't even sleep 4 hours a night. We're always policy, the politics, the people, the aspirations of the members, you know, so many things going on that you want the next person to do so much better because you have laid a foundation for them that you did not have. No offense to the people who went before me. It was just a different world. And so my excitement about it, and I was so excited about it, was that here they were ready to take over. Hakeem Jeffries to be the leader, Catherine Clark of Massachusetts. Well, Hakeem is from New York. Catherine Clark from Massachusetts. Pete Aguilar from California. Ted Lieu from California. They were outstanding, and there were many other outstanding members. So I knew that they could carry the ball, carry the torch, and the rest. So I was excited. My only hesitation was I had assembled, says she immodestly again, the greatest staff in the history of the Congress. Enormous talent on issues and process and parliamentary procedure, how to get things done. But happily for me, many of them are spread among the new leadership, so we still have the benefit of their, for those who wanted to stay, we still have that. So that went away kind of fast. But we have to win this election. I'm telling you, the House of Representatives, I love it. If those of you, if and when you read the book, will know. I love the House. People always said, why didn't you run for something else? Why would I run for something else? I'm in the House of Representatives. And then, of course, to be the Speaker. But it is so exuberant. It's like a bandwagon every day, as opposed to a convoy down the hall. that goes as slow as the slowest ship. But that's the way it is. And I make reference to that in the book, too. So they know what I think. But the thing is, the House can impeach.
Twice.
The House can impeach.
It can...
And we did on the basis of the law and the Constitution and the rest. They impeach if somebody does a stupid thing. You know, or they want to impeach, I don't know, Biden, what do they come up with something every day which has no basis. You can't have people be frivolous with the Constitution of the United States that our founders wrote to protect our rights, our country, our democracy. But there's a lot at risk in this election. Yeah.
So your decision to stay on the stage, yeah, even though you have given up the gavel. I mean, this book is about power, mm-hmm, and you still have a lot of power. I mean, we certainly have seen that over the last couple of months. This is my sneaky way of asking a Biden question. But so what do you think explains your own enduring influence and your own enduring power? Because it's not just connected to a title anymore.
Well, I don't have power. I mean, a speaker has awesome power. You pass laws, make committee assignments, recognized for speaking, all kinds of power. You don't, but so that power is different. Influence is a different thing. I think I have influence, but I don't really have power. So that's how I see it, yeah.
So our time is beginning to come to a close here, but we did ask for questions from some audience members. And I realize you are not here to fix the Republican Party, but one of our viewers named Gary Calhoun raises a question that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about as well. If Donald Trump does lose this election, where do you see the Republican Party, and especially those moderate Republicans that you were talking about? What happens going forward? Do you see any chance that there is still a core to the Republican Party that could sort of reject the MAGA movement, or are we just going to live with Trumpism?
Well, I'm probably the last person to ask about the future of the Republican Party. But as an observer, I would say what I said earlier, we need a strong Republican Party in our country. We need to recognize what was accomplished by the Republicans and the leadership that they have provided in the history of our country. It was founded by Abraham Lincoln. Well, it was founded by him. I don't know where he'd be now, but that's where it's founded. But I really do believe that there are, when I say this, I'm not talking about the Congress of the United States. Many serious Republicans out there who, see, here's what the Republicans have told me, the outside Republicans, not in the Congress. Well, let me just give you some inventory. You know, we had a vote on Roe v. Wade, first time in the history of our country that freedom was pulled back. From the beginning of our country, this Constitution of the United States, bad in some respects with slavery and that kind of thing, but amendable, abolished slavery. We then black men had the right to vote, then women eventually had the right to vote, and Roe v. Wade, all these things that happened until the Dobbs decision. It was the first time in the history of our country when freedom was reduced. Freedom was reduced by this court. Freedom was reduced. So I know, so when we took up a vote to enshrine Roe v. Wade in the law of the land, Of course, we didn't get one Republican vote. Okay, but that's what they believe. Okay, so not one Republican vote. Then I said, I'm going to put on the floor. This was 2 years ago when we still had the majority. I'm going to put on the floor Kathy Manning of North Carolina. She had the bill that said women have a right to contraception. Have a right to contraception. 195 Republicans voted no. 8 voted yes. That's the Republican Party in the Congress of the United States. 8 voted yes to say women have a right to contraception. Now, when I was putting that on the floor, members were saying to me, why are you doing that? They're all going to vote for it, and they'll get well from their Roe v. Wade vote. I said, why am I here, okay? You're nice, I'm not. Boom. 195 Republicans said, out of 203, that women do not have the right to contraception. So this is a very strange place. But what Republicans outside the Congress that I know, my friends, I do have Republican friends, and they said, if we can't beat them in the primary, you have to beat them in the general, and then we can go back to our competition on the role of government. You know, the traditional debate between Democrats and Republicans, rather than this divisive assault on our democracy that they exercised with a president of the United States inciting an insurrection on the Congress, on the Constitution, on the Capitol of the United States. Horrible. Coming after me for a bullet in the head, a noose for the vice president, and the president not sending the National Guard, even though he says, oh, I sent the... Get out of here. I mean, it's really so sad because they were like, oh, we can't do that. It takes time. But in any case, this is a very dangerous situation. So let's hope that we can win the election responsibly, unifyingly, invitingly for people to work together. And a lot of those Republicans, if you take a poll, background checks, 80% for gun violence protection, there are lots of Republicans, and they're gun owners. They have background checks, so why shouldn't everybody else? When you take a poll about raising the minimum wage, overwhelmingly, so many votes, overwhelming in the public, but not in the Congress of the United States. And of course, nothing demonstrates that more clearly than, of course, our inability to get background checks and ban assault weapons and that kind of thing, which has to be part of our first order of business when we win.
Well, Madam Speaker, this has been an absolute delight, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Again, thank you all. I wanted to thank you again. Thank you all very much.
Like, it's just going to be a vacuum. Everything's going to come out. The pipeline will be suspended, and the weight of the product and the pipeline itself will cause a collapse and a major oil spill. Could be another Kalamazoo here.
Right
here in Bad River. And from there, in 45 minutes, it could be all the way out into Lake Superior and on its journey along our shorelines out here. Mm-hmm. And that would also include the Apostle Islands. So currently, our court case, which we did win, by the way, And the judge is going to, he ordered the pipeline company to shut down Line 5 by, I believe it's July of 26. Mm. And right now, you got Michaels, you have the pipeline company itself, Enbridge. They're trying to fast track the reroute to go that additional 41 miles around Bad River. And all that's going to do is endanger more of our waterways. And it still endangers the Bad River. It still endangers Lake Superior, as well as all of the animals that need that water to survive, including us.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things we have to remind our listeners out there is that Enbridge is a foreign company that's digging up pipelines all over the United States and leaking pipelines. We had issues up in the beginning of the Mississippi with Line 3. And they still don't pick up their mess. They still don't tell us what's going through these pipelines, what's making this thick goobly gob of oil going through these pipelines, making it go through faster. And it's just a mess. And I can't believe in 2024 we're still talking about this, Joe.
And not only that, but when they have to slow that pipeline down and drop the pressure on it, how many minute cracks are there that oil could actually seep through? Now, a couple of years ago, just west of Ashland, we had an event take place on Line 5. It's approximately 1 mile west of the reservation. And I did fly my drone there and took pictures of what they did. And they claimed that it was 1 teaspoon of oil that dropped out of that segment of pipe at that joint. Now, I was there daily, and I saw how much dirt that they hauled out of there in those bins. That was way more. It had to be way more than a teaspoon of oil that they spilled. Now, a month ago, actually, they just finished up in August, I believe, Enbridge installed a check valve approximately a mile and a half east of the Bad River. And that check valve is, they would have had to cut the pipe open, shut the line down, cut the pipe open. My question is, with 540,000 gallons of oil or barrels of oil going through on a daily basis, how much was still residual in that line when they opened it up? Certainly it had to be more than a teaspoon that come out of there.
Yeah.
But yet we haven't heard. You know, we haven't heard how that process went from the actual Enbridge officials.
Yeah, and we're not surprised about that. You know, again, I got to back up here a second. It's going to be on Peacock, sure, the Bad River documentary. Thank you, Haley. And we had a chance to watch the documentary and also have the director on, and the story is compelling. Joe, I want to ask you, what can our listeners do? We have listeners all over the country watching us, listening to us on 30 other stations. What can they do to support your work, Joe?
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. One of the things that we have is we do have a link on our Bad River Tribal website, Defend the Bad River. You can make charitable contributions to help us with our legal expenses moving forward. And actually, there are places that are still showing the movie. And what they did was they paid 50% of the proceeds from the theaters. It came back to Bad River. The last update that I had, we received over $17,000 funds that were generated through ticket sales. And,
wow.
Greatly appreciated. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's amazing, too. And, Haley, what a documentary. And we talk the footage with the elbow, the way the river has changed, as Joe was saying. It's just a, you know, you can't stop water.
No. And yeah, it's only a matter of time before that erosion from the meandering river kind of takes down that corner and does expose that pipeline. And if you remember back to Kalamazoo and just how many gallons of oil was spilled during that. And now picture that going into Lake Superior. I mean, I know there's so many of us residents from across the states surrounding the Great Lakes that love to vacation or spend time around our Great Lakes, but these pipelines are really just poison, and it's a bomb waiting to go off.
Absolutely. And there's a number of right here through northern Wisconsin. We have all those waterways that lead to Lake Superior from Superior all the way through northern Wisconsin, as well as when you get over to the UP, of course, all the water there, all the rivers and streams, if they don't go north to the Lake Superior, they're going south to Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And then we have the issue under the straits. That's another reason why this pipeline actually needs to be shut down. We've got what's going on here in Bad River. We have what's going on in the straits, and combined, I mean, we're looking at a major disaster of apocalyptic proportions here. You know, with all the millions of people that rely on that good, clean water that we have up here in the Great Lakes region.
And we have a lot of allies, too, white allies that have resorts and fishing. They don't want to see this either. Again, we need to have some kind of plan of action, whether it's reaching out to the DNR or whomever and stop Enbridge again. I'm just worn out by this whole thing.
Right. The other thing that recently the Army Corps of Engineers had taken comments from the public, and we had over 150,000 comments against the reroute and the EIS that was turned in, put out there by the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, recently, they just put out a final draft, and I've yet to see what the final draft entails. I don't know if they changed it at all, but I'd certainly I'm interested in looking at it again.
Joe, can you hold on for another segment?
Sure. Yes, I will.
Right on. We're Joe Bates, Bad River Tribal Elder. We're talking about Line 5, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
The city of Minneapolis is now on Native Roots Radio with Minneapolis AIR. AIR stands for American Indian Relations. Guest host Christine McDonald talks to people about important things affecting the city's Native communities. Minneapolis AIR dives into topics like public safety, public health, elections, and so much more. Tune in to Minneapolis AIR on Native Roots Radio from 5 to 6 p.m. on the second Wednesday of every month, right here on AM 950.
J&S Bean Factory is a Native-owned, community-supported, cozy, artsy coffee shop which offers roasted on-site beans, live music, and baked goods. Relax in the beautiful outside patio. City Pages writes, voted top 10 coffee shops. Tucked into a quiet corner of St. Paul's Highland Park neighborhood, this coffee shop roasts beans on-site from the best coffee-growing countries in the world. Located at 1518 Randolph Avenue, St. Paul. The good stuff.
I've often said the RAV4 from Rudy Luther Toyota is the best vehicle I've ever driven, and I just had it proven to me once again. I drove around San Francisco and the Sierra Nevadas in a RAV4 hybrid, and it was sensational. The city driving was amazing, tackling tight corners and steep city streets while looking stylish. The real challenge came when we got up into the mountain roads, and the RAV4 carved them up like a hot knife through butter. And the hybrid fuel efficiency saved me over $200 on my vacation. Win, win, win. Test drive a Toyota RAV4 today at Rudy Luther Toyota, 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
And we're back to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot.
This portion of the show is supported by Howling for Wolves, protecting wolves for future generations.
How?
How?
Yeah, hey, Joe. Did we do that back in the day? Hey, we're with Joe Bates, Bad River Elder, Tribal Elder, and we're talking about Line 5. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement with the film? Amazing film.
I did have a little segment in there, a few lines. I like the fact that they did use some of my drone footage in the movie. During the high water event, and then I narrated that small segment there, and then just in the closing as well, I was really impressed with how well the movie was put together, I had no idea that we had that many people that were going to be involved in it. And I thought it was great, you know, to get a broad spectrum. Sorry about the shaking. The broad spectrum of everyone's involvement. We had people that were pro-pipeliners that were also interviewed. But a number of them refused to have their interviews put on in the movie. I'm not sure why, but you know, to them, it looks like a one-sided type movie, but it was given the opportunity from the opposition to speak out as well, of which they didn't want to go public with.
Well, but, Haley, it was a very emotional ending, wasn't it, Haley?
Oh.
Yeah, it was.
That ending was beautiful and believable and unbelievable.
Yeah, the film we're talking about is the Bad River film documentary by Mary Mazzio and Joe Bates here, who we're speaking with. Bad River Tribal Elder had a role in that. I encourage everyone to check out the Bad River documentary, which will be out on Peacock in November.
Absolutely. And then it currently, if you go to badriverfilms.com, it may take you to a link where you can actually watch it free right now. And then, like I say, you can always go once you see the movie, if you feel compelled that you'd like to help us with our fight, you go to badrivertribe.gov and click on the link to donate to Defend a Bad River. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's crazy. Joe, I'm going to have you on just for a couple more minutes here. I wanted you to give that information, and I'm glad you did. It's just, again, we started this, if you remember, Joe, we started this show because of Standing Rock and all the misinformation. So we appreciate you coming on and also having that amazing documentary that Haley spoke of that we had an opportunity to watch and have the director and writer on, and her amazement by, I think, peeling back the onion and seeing really what natives are really dealing with when it comes to everything just amazed her. She thought she was going to learn about just pipelines, and she learned about a lot of the things that we go through as Indigenous people of the North.
As well as the other thing that we have coming up is Enbridge has meddled in our internal affairs here. They meddled in our last election that took Mike Wiggins Jr. out of the chairman's position. Whoa. And currently, we have another election coming up in November of this year, and we have three positions on that ballot up for election. We have our vice chair, our junior council member, as well as our secretary. Our current secretary is, and I'll mention it, his name is Jay McPhee, because it's on court documents. It's in federal court records for him colluding with Enbridge employees, April Holdren, who is she was a public relations person here in Bad River up until the federal court case. Jay McPhee met with April Holdren on a number of accounts and shared information with her at a dining table right here in Odena. And, you know, and currently they have they're trying to meddle in with this election as well. They're already attacking me. I did get on the ballot for junior council member. I feel it's my inherent duty to preserve what we have, and it's the least I can do to help protect what we have for the next seven generations.
Wow, so, well, good for you.
Tribal members, I appreciate your vote of support.
Good for you for stepping up, too. And I'm just so, you know, when Enbridge and Line 3 were here in the Twin Cities, they infiltrated all our high school sports, our tournaments, our hockey tournaments, our basketball tournaments. They were sponsoring it like they were the good neighbor. And basically, they didn't hire people. They brought their own people in all across the country. They didn't, all the things that they promised never came to fruition. They got $20 an hour jobs with no health care to tribal members up north, and it was ridiculous. So, Joe, I appreciate so much what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much. Like I said, it's the least I can do. So,
well, is there anybody or any website or Facebook that we could support your running for tribal office?
Well, I do have a Cash App, and I also do take Venmo payments as well as just Facebook Messenger payments.
Right on. So, that's Joe Bates, Bad River Tribal
donations
Elder.
for election materials would be appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, I know it's spendy, and I know that it costs. So, Joe, again, one more time on how people can find the Bad River, what's going on, the website again.
Yes, that our tribal website is badrivertribe.gov. And it'll bring you to our main page. Right there in the top right-hand corner is, there you go. And there you go. You got the link right there. So you can click on the tab on our page, and you can go from there. Just follow the instructions.
DefendTheBadRiver.org, all one word.
Yes.
Joe, thank you so much for being on, and let's do this again real quick, as soon as we can again. Let's do this again. Let's not make it 7 years.
Okay. All right. That sounds great. That sounds great. Thank you very much for having me on, and I appreciate it. It's an honor. Thank you.
Pinigigi, we'll see you soon, Joe. Good luck, and we'll be watching what's going on there and reporting. Thank you so much. Wow. Well, Haley, amazing guest again. Amazing show. Really appreciate the production value that you give Native Roots Radio. It was just really, really good. Thank you so much.
Oh, of course. It's my pleasure. And it's really, you know, people like Joe and Rachel Thunder who provide this great content, keep us updated with the important issues going.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, our statewide Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest continues, and we debut a completely legitimate and totally real new attack ad. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey.
pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.